Dave Emery, and this is slide one of For the Record program number 490. This is being recorded on December 12th of the year 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, and also the prime mover behind Consortium News. Robert, welcome once again to our airways.
Thank you, Dave.
As we're speaking on December 12th of 2004, I feel confident in speaking for Robert and certainly for myself that these are not happy times, and in particular, I just heard a piece of very, very bad news about a subject that's well known to people in my professional days here in the Silicon Valley, and something we've spoken about at great length over the years, namely the Iran-Contra-related drug smuggling. And veteran listeners will be aware of Gary Webb's heroic story for the San Jose Mercury News called Dark Alliance, which later spawned a book of the same name. Sadly, very sadly, Gary Webb is no longer with us. He allegedly took his own life on Friday. Perhaps it was a suicide. Who knows? But whether or not he did in fact succumb to depression, certainly I think we could say that his professional career was assassinated. And the Iran-Contra drug smuggling story is one that, you've covered at great length, Robert, and it's something that is near and dear to you, and you also have suffered professionally. Share with us, if you would, your thoughts about Gary Webb's life, his passing, and what your reflections are on that at this point in time.
Well, the Gary Webb story is perhaps one of the saddest, darkest moments in modern American journalistic history. It's hard to even, as bad as journalism may be, it's hard to think of a point when the mainstream press performed as horridly as they did in connection with Gary Webb. And the story, in the story of the Contra drug operations, go back to the mid-80s. I was with the Associated Press and working with Brian Barger on, originally this, our stories were focused more on Oliver North's secret operations to support the Contras, who were the Nicaraguan rebels fighting the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. And they had been supported by the CIA and the Reagan-Bush administration, and Congress had cut off their assistance by the mid-80s. And to augment that that money, they really expanded their involvement, the Contras did, with the drug trafficking. And a number of Contra units, both in Costa Rica and Honduras, really involving all the major Contra, you know, organizations, were implicated in drug trafficking. And they worked with the Medellin cartel and other significant drug players in Central America and in Mexico, as well as with some of the Cuban American networks in Miami. This was a very bad scandal. We did the first piece for AP in December of 85 on it. It was followed up on by a young senator, a freshman senator named John Kerry, who did some heroic work of his own, digging into this and finding a great deal of corroborating evidence and support. And frankly, you know, some of our sources were people in the Reagan-Bush administration who told us they knew about this stuff. It was really internally known contemporaneously. We knew this. That the Reagan administration knew about the Contra drug trafficking and had to cover it up because Ronald Reagan and people in his administration saw the Contras as an important weapon in the Cold War. They put geopolitics ahead of protecting the country from drug trafficking. That was the sick, serious problem. But the Washington Press Corps, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other major news organizations, mainstream news organizations, as well as some of the conservative outfits like the Washington Times, attacked Kerry, and they attacked us for doing these stories. They tried to denigrate the stories. They insisted that it wasn't true that the Contras were involved in drug trafficking. And really, the New York Times did as bad a job as can be imagined in trying to protect the image of the Contras. It was part of this idea that these were such serious allegations that the American people should know about them. And there was a feeling of rallying around the president and protecting, the image of the United States. And this cover-up, there's very few ways other than that to describe it, continued through the late 1980s In Kerry's investigation, though, it found a great deal of information and was published in 1989, was buried by the major news organizations. There was a point in the early 1990s, after we invaded Panama and arrested Manuel Noriega, that the U.S. government actually put on witnesses in the Noriega trial who also said a part of our operation was funneling money to Noriega, but it was also to work with the Contras. These were like Colombian cartel leaders. And so there was even admission by the U.S. government, but there was a strange disconnect that the major Washington Press Corps people just didn't want to accept it, wanted to denigrate these stories. There were conspiracy theories, even when the U.S. government itself said they were true. And that's pretty much where the story sat, sort of in that netherworld of something that, you know, might be verifiably true but still not accepted by the people that matter. And so many Americans were confused about whether it's true or not. They were certainly they're confused at that time. And it wasn't until the mid-1990s. Actually, I got a phone call from Gary Webb. And he had found in work he was doing in Los Angeles that some of the suspects in some drug cases there had been hooked up with the Contra drug operations. And that some of their work on spreading crack cocaine was supported by cocaine that was being brought in under this umbrella. And I warned Gary Webb, since I had gone through this, I had seen how unpleasant it was, how ugly the attacks had been from the Washington Post, New York Times, and other major outlets on anyone who would consider these stories. You know, I cautioned him about doing this piece for the San Jose Mercury News. And I think he thought I was a bit of a coward, frankly. I think he may have thought, you know, what's this guy, what kind of a weenie journalist is this who says that this would, you know, that you shouldn't just do the story. So, to his credit, he went ahead and he did the story. I'm not sure he was entirely happy with the editing that he got at the San Jose Mercury News, but the story moved as the Dark Alliance series. And it was essentially correct, as far as I knew. The stuff about certainly the Contras being involved in significant drug trafficking, that was true. Webb did focus on a couple of sort of narrow points, which I think allowed some of his denigrators to then suggest that he was just looking at those small points. But he was looking at real channels of Contra cocaine, but there were multiple channels of Contra cocaine. This was a significant operation as part of the cocaine flow that was pouring into the United States in the 1980s. So he did this series. Initially, it also appeared on the Internet. It was one of the first big Internet investigative stories because the San Jose Mercury News, being in Silicon Valley, had a very sophisticated website. So it represented a challenge to the established press in a variety of ways, partly the Internet, and partly because the African-American community just rose up in fury over this. And the Black Caucus in the U.S. Congress demanded answers. So what happened is that the major papers, I guess you might say the white guys, got together and they decided to put it all down. And the New York Times and the Washington Post and the L.A. Times just put it down. They wrote these wretched stories that quibbled with little points and denounced Webb. And the New York Times even went out and essentially did opposition research on Webb, digging into his past and writing a piece about challenging some earlier stories he had written. It was truly ugly. And, you know, our website, consortiumnews.com, was one of the few places that was backing him up because I had this experience having covered all this stuff, and I knew that, you know, not knowing all the details about L.A., but knowing that the broad picture he was drawing was correct. So that's what was going on in that period. Eventually, the pressure got so intense that his editor, Jerry Sipos of the San Jose Mercury News, essentially betrayed Webb, betrayed the story, backed off.
By the way, let me just interrupt ever so briefly, Robert. I, of course, live and work in the Silicon Valley and remember vividly when the Dark Alliance series first came out. I was reading the Sunday Mercury News and it was all over the front page. Gary Webb was then taken off of the main news feed and put, first of all, in the Cupertino Bureau, and that's a tiny little town here. I mean, it's the home of Apple Computer, but it was certainly a major demotion professionally. And then ultimately, he was he arrived in Sacramento professionally. So it this all took place right under the noses, not only of yours truly, but many of the listeners who will be listening to the initial broadcast here in the Silicon Valley. Go ahead.
Well, it's important to know who did what, and Jerry Sipos was his editor, and who essentially sold out not only of the follow-up stories that they were underway. There were Webb and some people he was other journalists he was working with, including some in Central America, were developing additional leads to follow up, and those stories were cut short. And Webb was essentially forced out of journalism. It's a great celebration of the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the L.A. Times. What happened is that as ugly as all that was, what Webb was able to do was to get the CIA and the Department of Justice to conduct investigations. And they were carried out by the Inspector General of the two agencies. And the investigations weren't the greatest, I suppose, in some ways. They obviously were protective of the government and the agencies in some ways. But they also dug out some very important historical truths. And if one were to read beyond the press releases that came out with those investigations, what you would see is that it was that what was acknowledged by the agencies themselves was that this was a far worse, far darker scandal than anybody had ever imagined, than I had imagined, that John Kerry had imagined, or that Gary Webb had imagined. That there was systematic, repeated, overwhelming cases of the U.S. government preventing investigations into drug traffickers because they were tied up with the Contras. That in some cases, leads were just not followed. In some cases, investigators who were trying to pursue these areas were stopped. People were simply protected. They were allowed to carry out their drug trafficking because it was considered more important to overthrow the government in Nicaragua than it was to expose the Contras, for the drug traffickers that some of them had become, that many of them had become. So this was the reality, and it was strange. I mean, we had these reports coming out from the government admitting large swaths of what Webb and Kerry and those of us at AP in the earlier days had reported, and all of which had been ridiculed and denigrated by the big newspapers. And so what the big newspapers did was simply refuse to report the substance of these findings. They report maybe what was in the press releases, which tended to say, well, you know, the CIA was not involved in selling cocaine on the street corners of Los Angeles. But they would not look and see what was actually in the reports, which were that the CIA and the DEA and other federal agencies, the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. embassies in Central America, had protected the Contra drug traffickers. And the most damning of the reports was the second volume of the report done by the CIA Inspector General Frederick Hitz. And Hitz, I must say, did a commendable job in this. He was much more honest than pretty much anything we'd seen in the press corps. And what he found was that there had been a large number of cases, and that some of these cases of Contra drug traffickers went right in to the CIA. They went right into the National Security Council at the White House under Reagan and Bush. These were devastating admissions. But again, this did not go with the way that the big papers wanted. The New York Times did do a front page story kind of saying, well, I guess there was more here than we had thought initially, but Gary Webb is still a jerk, basically, was their story. The LA Times never reported on this when the report by the CIA Inspector General was issued. They simply ignored it. The Washington Post waited a month after it came out and did a very sloppy, inadequate job. So the tragedy of all this is that the history was finally being laid out. And it's a tragic, terrible history, but one that the American people needed to know. And the major papers, because they had gotten the story so wrong for so long, couldn't reverse themselves. They didn't have the decency to just say, hey, we were over the top in our criticism of Gary Webb. We were wrong. They would not help Gary Webb recover his career. And one of the really weird twists of all this is that the editor, Jerry Sipos, who essentially sold out Webb and sold out the story, was given an award by the Society of Professional Journalists because of his courage in sort of reversing the series at the San Jose Mercury News and backing away from it. It was the world turned upside down from what it ought to be to what it had become. And I think the tragedy that this was allowed to go on, never to be corrected, and I'm sure that the folks at the LA Times just felt if we just look the other way and don't ever really recognize the reality that we've been covering up, it will just disappear. It will go away. But things have consequences. And tragically, one of these consequences may have been that, although we don't know why Webb took his own life, supposedly, but certainly, as his wife told the LA Times in the obit that I read today, he never recovered from what was done to him in the mid-1990s.
A couple of things that come to mind. Listeners will probably, by the time this program airs, listeners will have, at least some of them will have read accounts. Some people came up to his door for a professional engagement. There was a note attached to Gary Webb's door in his Sacramento dwelling that said basically, do not enter, call 911 and an ambulance. When that was done, investigators found him dead of an apparently self-inflicted gunshot wound. A couple of notes, right here in the Silicon Valley, we experienced another very similar death. The late Iris Chang, a very heroic journalist who was the author of a landmark book about the rape of Nanking, entitled The Rape of Nanking, also allegedly took her life with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. At least one author who worked with her, with whom I've communicated, was skeptical about that. Who knows? But it's another blow of a similar type. That just happened on November 11th, or her body was discovered on November 11th. A couple of other things that come to mind. Political comedian Mort Saul, in his autobiography, asked the question, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? Is it too late for America? Something I think people like Jerry Sipos and people at the LA Times, Washington Post, and New York Times might want to think about. I'm also reminded of an old Turkish proverb, Robert. He who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. And I was stunned. I had not heard the news when I spoke with you before we went on the air. And, well, what can one say? Rest in peace, Gary Webb. And we will do what we can to carry on his legacy. Is there anything else you wanted to mention about Gary Webb's passing, or shall we move on to related topics here?
Well, I think that the country owes a huge debt to Gary Webb. The United States, if it is to survive as a democratic society, has to know its own history, has to know what the people in power have done. And Gary Webb made this huge contribution that he forced the government to dig into its own records. And because there were some honest people in the government, in these inspector general offices, that information was provided. The terrible, painful irony is that it was the major news organizations, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times, that refused to take this information that even the accused agencies were providing and pass it on to the American people. It was those news organizations that really should be ashamed. And not just because of the tragedy involving Gary Webb, but the broader tragedy of failing to do their jobs and tell the truth and deal with serious scandals when the evidence is there It's a very dark, it's a very dark chapter of our country's history. And I think there is in that, there are people who have behaved heroically, who deserve credit. And one of them is Jerry Webb. And I must say one of the troubling aspects of reading these obits is that the LA Times, they called me, by the way, and I did talk to the reporter, and I went through some of this. But since the LA Times had never reported about the CIA's Inspector General findings, the LA Times obit only goes with its determination that Jerry Webb's story was false. So the LA Times has so locked itself up in its own false reporting, dishonest reporting, that it can't even report on Jerry Webb's death with any honesty.
How many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? As Mort Saul noted, yes, it's disgraceful. It's disgraceful. And the way one must respond is, first of all, to remember. I think it is perhaps even greater sin to forget or to become distracted from these realities, however unpleasant. It's very important to remember the work that Gary Webb did in concert with work such as that you did and also John Kerry, tackling not only that story in Congress but also the related BCCI investigation. It's important that the tree of liberty, which may have been watered with the blood of people like Gary Webb or Iris Chang, continue to be nourished and respectfully pruned by those of us who survived them. Anyway, Robert, let's move on to a related subject. Now, you have written your latest book, and you have published your latest book, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, which deals with many of these related issues. One of the cocaine-related political machinations that will be familiar to longtime veteran listeners to this program, and something which opens up a vista on some of the Contra-related drug trafficking, that is the overthrow of the Bolivian government in 1980, in which basically the replacement of the democratic government with a bunch of coca fascisti, so to speak, came to be known as the cocaine coup. Tell us about the cocaine coup and the role in it of people like Klaus Barbie and associates.
Well, the whole history of this region and the secret intelligence operations that have that weave through South America. Some of them even go back to World War II in the final days of World War II when some of the Nazis were allowed to escape over rat lines to South America. As people, I'm sure, know, in Argentina, the Perón government had been very sympathetic to the Nazis and they provided a safe haven for some of them who were able to escape. And some of them escaped with the aid of the early CIA and Western intelligence services, because in the post-World War II era, the priority became combating the Soviet Union, not punishing the Nazis. So, and we saw this also, by the way, in Asia, where some of the war criminals from the Japanese militarist government were released because they could be used to help put down worker demonstrations and student demonstrations and other leftist threats, because the U.S. government considered the bigger danger at that point the rise of the Soviet Union and its power. So that's the backdrop. So there was this permission granted. In some cases, these people snuck in. Other times, they were allowed into these already right-wing military governments in South America, and they brought with them some of the skills that they had learned as Nazi war criminals. People like Klaus Barbie, who was known as the Butcher of Lyon, for his role in the SS in killing Jews and other enemies, perceived enemies of the Third Reich. So these folks came in and they merged with some of the already generally repressive, although clumsier, military regimes in South America, and as the politics of that region evolved over the 50s and 60s, the U.S. obsession with combating communism also factored in. And there were some closer and closer alliances between U.S. intelligence and some of these governments and some of these military leaders who seized power or held power. People like General Pinochet in Chile, who seized power in 1973. People like the Argentine generals who seized power in 1976. And there were efforts to sort of stop any kind of leftist or even rather moderate Christian Democrats, Christian Democratic organizations and leaders were being assassinated as part of these military regimes. And that leads us to the period of 79 and 80 when a left-of-center government was in power in Bolivia. And in this case, some of the right-wing regimes of Argentina and Chile helped support some of these operations of the right in Bolivia, which wanted to get rid of this government. And the right-wing military in Bolivia also teamed up with some of the early cocaine producers. At that point, the kinds of cocaine cartels that we got to be familiar with in the 80s had not really solidified. And it was actually in Bolivia where much of the impetus for these cartels began to emerge. And the military in Bolivia, working with Klaus Barbie, who had been a former Nazi war criminal who was a fugitive.
And also, by the way, someone who had worked for U.S. intelligence, as you had discussed earlier, and something that's familiar to veteran listeners. But Robert, we're almost out of time, but we've got about one more minute before we got to wrap. Go ahead.
Well, anyway, these neo-Nazi and right-wing groups teamed up with these early cartel groups and overthrew the government of Bolivia, and it became known as the cocaine coup. And that provided the safe supply of coca to groups in Medellin and in Colombia that became the Medellin cartel. So there's this direct link between these right-wing operations in places like Bolivia that seized power and what became this flood of cocaine into the United States.
Alrighty, Robert, we will continue this discussion in the other side of our program. The material that we've just discussed is covered at great length and in great detail in Secrecy and Privilege. Tell the audience where they can get that book.
Well, they can go to a special website, secrecyandprivilege.com. They also can go to consortiumnews.com, which is our main news site. And it's also available at amazon.com.
Alrighty, and also there are many other articles available on consortiumnews.com. This interview will be archived on www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. It will be available for download only on Real Audio at www.spitfirelist.com. And please be aware of the Spitfire website again, www.spitfirelist.com. It has a wealth of material, including written article-length descriptions of the various programs that I have done over the years. We have been visiting with Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, just published. And we will be continuing with our discussion with Robert Perry on the other side of this program. This concludes Side 1 of For the For Record program number 490, another interview with Robert Perry, being recorded on December 12, 2004. For Robert Perry, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 490, another interview with Robert Perry. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present to the audience once again Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, just published. Robert, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks, Dave.
At the conclusion of Side 2, we were talking about the cocaine coup and former SS man and former U.S. intelligence operative Klaus Barbie. I wonder if, briefly, if you could encapsulate that, and then we're going to go on to overlapping topics.
Well, in 1980, the Bolivian military leaders, working with Klaus Barbie, who had been in their intelligence service, along with some of the drug producers in Bolivia, teamed up and overthrew the government of Bolivia and basically seized control of an entire country. It became known as the cocaine coup because of the key role of cocaine in both financing the coup and then operating the government from then on for the next couple of years before the government collapsed. But in that interim period, while this cocaine coup government was in power in Bolivia, it was able to provide this impetus of essentially protected supplies of coca up to Colombia. And that became the initial way that the Colombian drug cartels, particularly the Medellin cartel, got going. They were relying on the supply of coca from this right-wing government in Bolivia that had seized power.
We're going to return to the cocaine coup as part of the seed, I guess one could say, of the Iran-Contra-related drug trafficking that we were talking about. But inside one, we were talking about the collaboration between various right-wing regimes in Latin America and also Klaus Barbie and his bridegrooms or fiancés of death. As veteran listeners will be aware of, and as you mentioned in your book, a couple of the people who were involved with the bridegrooms of death were two Italian-based fascists named Pierluigi Pagliai, who was actually a member of the Propaganda Due Lodge, well-known to veteran listeners of this program, and also Stefano Della Chiai, one of the authors of The Strategy of Tension, a program of deliberate terror in order to subvert democracy in Italy. One of the things that you write about in your book, and one thing that will be familiar to, again, are the long-time listeners to this show, was Operation Condor and the machinations that freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger, in his landmark text, The Great Heroin Coup, termed the Internacional Fascista. Barbie, as veteran listeners know, was involved with this. Tell us about Operation Condor, Robert, and what that was, how it overlapped, for example, the killing of Orlando Letelier, and who was director of the CIA when that took place.
Well, there were some very key moments in terms of modern American history that go back to that period in the mid-1970s. In 1973, of course, the Pinochet coup occurs. This is this overthrow of the democratically elected government in Chile. There was Allende, who was the president, was considered too leftist for Washington's taste. The Nixon administration then sponsored a program to destabilize the Chilean government, which was followed by a violent military coup led by General Pinochet, who massacred many of the political dissidents, tortured others. Some of these stories are still coming out at this point many years later. That event became also one of the early CIA scandals that emerged in the post-Watergate period of around 1975. Americans were shocked to find that their government had engaged in this kind of operation to overthrow a democratically elected government. George Bush Sr. was brought in to be CIA director by then-President Ford in part to calm those waters. Bush promised Ford that he would get the CIA off of the front pages. In 1976, while Bush was CIA director, the very violent Argentinian coup also occurs, where the generals take over. They begin the so-called disappearances of political opponents. 30,000 people were put to death in pretty gruesome ways. These different military dictatorships then teamed up. They formed an international alliance, in different concepts. We would call it a terrorist alliance, because what they would do is they would hunt down dissidents, in different countries. So when a Christian democratic leader might go from Chile to Argentina, he and his wife might be gunned down on the streets. Or if some people went to Europe, they'd be attacked on the streets of Europe by agents sent by these South American governments. And the organization that carried out these assassinations became known as Operation Condor, in honor of the bird, the national bird of Chile. So you had this very grim approach to supposedly combating communism, It often spilled over to combating anybody who these governments felt might be opposed to them.
Including some relatively conservative social democrats who had previously held political office in some of these countries.
Even Christian Democrats were targeted in these operations. So you had basically anyone who was seen as a threat to their to these military regimes was vulnerable to be assassinated, even when they were in other countries far away. Now, this was the situation when Bush was CIA director. He remained close to these people. Even to this day, he has continued to defend Pinochet when Pinochet has come under legal pressure for these activities. George Bush Sr. has been one of the people who has intervened to try to prevent Pinochet from being prosecuted. But while this is happening, one reason those later interventions are so stunning was that in September of 1976, while there was a presidential campaign underway in the United States, Jimmy Carter was running against Gerald Ford, the Chileans mounted an assassination, a Condor assassination, in Washington, D.C. itself. They were upset about the activities of a former foreign minister under the Allende government named Orlando Letelier, and he was targeted for assassination. And the U.S. government knew various pieces of this. There was an effort to get false visas for the travel through the U.S. embassy in Paraguay for the assassins. And that was referred to the CIA, but the ambassadors tried to stop it. He realized there was something fishy about this, but he never got a real explanation from the CIA as to what was going on or what it might know about it. But he tried to block it. But the assassins were then sent in in a slightly different way, and they arrived in the United States, collaborating with anti-Castro Cubans who were based here, also who had close ties to the CIA. And they went to Washington and planted a bomb under the car of Letelier. And as he was driving with two American co-workers through one of the most secure parts of Washington, the so-called Embassy Row, where a number of the embassies are located on Massachusetts Avenue, the assassins detonated the bomb, killed Letelier, killed one of his co-workers, a woman named Ronnie Moffitt, wounded her husband. The evidence immediately pointed at the Chilean government. But because there was a lot of U.S. complicity and knowledge here, the CIA under George Bush began to point investigators in different directions. Instead of providing the evidence that they had internally at CIA, which is quite compelling and would have solved the crime quite quickly, they insisted that the evidence pointed in different directions. The CIA put out statements saying that the Chilean government was innocent. And it really wasn't for another year or two that the FBI and federal prosecutors were able to crack the case. As one of them told me, with no help from the CIA. And they found later that the CIA had in its internal records even a photograph of the lead assassin, a man named Townley, because he'd made that earlier effort to go through Paraguay. So you have you had here the kind of collaboration or averting of eyes that we see over and over again when the U.S. government is dealing with very unsavory people, but who have in various ways served this broader geopolitical interest of the United States. And this is also where often the Washington National Press Corps comes in trying to not focus too much on the real dark underbelly of U.S. foreign policy, because it's so distressing to many people, and because some people in the media who are really see themselves as part of the establishment don't want the American people to understand all these dark corners. They'd rather either try to finesse them, not be too frank about them, or simply ignore them when possible. But the background of this the case of these South American governments is very important in understanding how extreme the U.S. Authorities became, especially in the period of the mid 70s and later in the 1980s, in supporting people who were both assassins, terrorists, drug traffickers, because those people were seen as serving this larger policy of Cold War, a Cold War approach to the world.
Now, let's jump back to the cocaine coup, which we touched on in side one. You mentioned some of the Argentine death squads and their role in facilitating the cocaine coup. And we talked about Klaus Barbie. I wonder if you would encapsulate for us Mr. Sanchez Reyesa, his role in that, and how the cocaine coup came to be sort of the germ for what later blossomed into the Contra cocaine connection.
Right. It's very important to understand how those moments in the late 70s with the Argentine this military regime in Argentina supported the cocaine coup in Bolivia. They sent their people to assist their friends in the Bolivian government who were staging the coup in the military. So they also began to benefit from the money from the cocaine trafficking that was going on. And one of the leaders of this sort of intelligence operation that the Argentines were lending around to different places was this fellow Reyesus. And he then moved on after assisting in the operation in Bolivia. He moved on to Honduras, and one of his roles in Honduras was working with this this Argentine battalion to train Nicaraguans who had been defeated, overthrown by the leftist Sandinista government, and were now had fled to Honduras, and this became the core of the Contra movement. Initially, people may forget this, but initially the Contras were not trained by the CIA; they were trained by Argentine intelligence, and many of the death squad operations that the Argentine intelligence services had practiced in Buenos Aires, and even to the point of taking people and throwing them into the ocean to drown, some of these tactics were then replicated in Central America, either by some of the right-wing governments like Guatemala or El Salvador, but also with the Contras, who were this rebel force fighting to overthrow the government of Nicaragua. So you had some of the techniques being passed on, and you had the financing. And the financing for the Argentine operations from this fellow Reyes was drug money. And he described in testimony later how this worked and how the money laundering operations occurred through Miami, and how some of the money went for things like supporting the government in Bolivia. Other money was moved to the Contras. And so the Contras, from their very inception, were hooked on cocaine money, and that's where they grew out of. And so they were in close collaboration with the Medellin cartel from the very beginning, and there was also a cartel in Honduras that worked closely with them, and there were elements of these corrupt elements of the governments of those regions that worked with the Contras in shipping cocaine to the United States. So that's the backdrop. The backdrop is that the Contras were always knee deep in cocaine. And then when the CIA took them over in the early part of the Reagan-Bush administration, they were already dealing with these people. And they knew who they were dealing with. The U.S. government knew full well that these folks were involved in drug trafficking. But they felt they had to look the other way, because the larger point that the Reagan-Bush administration wanted carried out was to get rid of the Sandinistas. That was the top priority. And since then, we now have a lot of documentation on this, including the CIA's Inspector General report, which describes the fact that the whole idea of looking the other way on drug trafficking was understood from the beginning of the Contra operation.
Tell us about the Moon Organization, Robert. They were involved in the cocaine coup, and then we're going to examine, in as much time as we have left, perhaps we can continue this in another discussion, but the Moon Organization, something that you write about extensively in Secrecy and Privilege, an organization that's not generally very well understood. Let's begin by talking about the Moon Organization's role in the cocaine coup.
Well, Reverend Sun Myung Moon was, of course, a Korean theocrat, if you will. He believed that he should run the world through a religious government, and that there should be no other power but his. And he is this extreme egotist who was seen as useful back in the 60s by the South Korean government in terms of spreading influence or sending money or for various intelligence purposes. But Moon became close to the Yakuza crime families of Japan because of the ties between Korea and Japan that were developing in that time frame. And they basically helped fund him with their, they of course are tied up also in criminal activities, including drug trafficking. Moon then moves on to South America in the 70s, and his operations include support of the Bolivian cocaine coup. And Moon sends one of his top lieutenants, to Bohipak to meet with the leaders of the cocaine coup government in 1980, and and Bohipak raises a throne for Reverend Moon as the highest city in South America, the Bolivian capital. So you have this sort of friendly relationship that grows out of this. And the Moon operations also are, of course, tied up very soon with the Contras, because they're part of this World Anti-Communist League. They're part of this effort to defeat communism. And so they're working hand in glove with these corrupted right-wing regimes in South America and with the operations in Central America, including the Contras. So they become a key factor in that operation as it evolves in Central America. They protect the Contras. They protect the Contras not just by assisting them, but they also, in the meantime, have been building, in the period after the cocaine coup, suddenly Moon has huge sums of money to deal with. And he comes into Washington in 1982 and sets up the Washington Times with hundreds of millions of dollars of completely mysterious money. Nobody knows where it comes from. And it's used to set up this essentially a propaganda operation in support of the Reagan-Bush administration. And as part of that, when reporters or like John Kerry, when he was investigating the Contra drug trafficking problem, the Washington Times took the lead in attacking Kerry and took its lead in attacking people like, you know, Brian Barger, me at the Associated Press, when we were digging into these drug trafficking problems involving Central America. In other words, Moon provided cover for these drug traffickers, many of whom he was essentially in bed with.
And the Moon organization is also something that is very, very close to the Bush family. One of the things that you write about, both in Secrecy and Privilege, something you also covered in an article familiar to veteran listeners, The Dark Side of Reverend Moon, was the munificence that the Moon organization has bestowed on the elder George Bush after he left the White House. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, the Bush family understood a good thing when they saw it. I mean, here was Moon providing essentially free propaganda funded by this money that was coming in from overseas being laundered into the United States. And what the Reagan-Bush administration provided was protection. I mean, Moon was having some legal troubles in the late 70s. There was an investigation of his operation which tied it into the so-called Korea Gate influence buying scheme. Those allegations led to a prosecution in the early 1980s of Moon which was essentially a money laundering investigation, but framed as a tax evasion case. And Moon did go to jail. But there were efforts by even then by the Reagan-Bush administration to keep Moon from being prosecuted. And after he got out, there were efforts to prevent any renewed investigation, even though the evidence remained quite clear that Moon continued to launder large sums of money illegally into the United States to fund his operations. So you had this effort to protect Moon because he was providing this propaganda apparatus. And after, and this went on through the late 1980s, of course, Moon was very big, and his paper was big in attacking Michael Dukakis as psychiatrically unfit in 1988 with some phony stories. In 1992, the Washington Times attacked Bill Clinton for allegedly being a KGB operative. I mean, it was pretty much wherever they could sort of get in motion to discredit the Democrats and protect the Bush interests, they would. And then after Bush Sr. lost in 92 and went into private life, the Moon operation began to funnel large sums to him for speaking fees. He and Barbara would give talks on behalf of the Moon organization in the United States, in Asia, and also in South America. There was one notable speech that Bush gave with Moon present in Buenos Aires, in which he said he described Moon as the man with the vision, and he received, you know, amounts that are not, have never been fully determined. I was told by someone in the Moon organization that they had earmarked $10 million for payments to George Bush Sr. Whether or not he ever got that much, I don't know. The Bush people have always refused to divulge how much Moon paid George Bush Sr. But Moon kept his operations going with vast, mysterious sums of money to the present day. And they obviously were very important in supporting George Bush Jr., both in their attacks on Al Gore in 2000 and their attacks on John Kerry in 2004. So the Washington Times, while not perhaps well known to a large number of Americans, since it's a paper that publishes in Washington, but it's extremely influential because it's on the streets in Washington all the time. The stories it puts out are picked up by Rush Limbaugh or picked up by other conservative news outlets. And so it puts themes in play that then can be used to discredit the Democrats or anybody who gets in the way of the ruling crowd that the Moon people find that they have common interests with. And one of those interests is that the Republicans have protected from any kind of criminal investigation for really since the early 1980s.
Robert, we've just got a few minutes left here, so we're going to have to move quickly. But another beneficiary of the Wealth of the Moon organization, and someone who has once again sort of assumed center stage with the values, unquote, discussion that has occupied the political stage at this time, that's Reverend Jerry Falwell. Tell us about Falwell and Moon. And again, we're really limited for time here.
Well, you know, one of Moon's practices is that when people are having hard times on the conservative side, when they're running out of money, they're having financial crises, Moon steps in with vast sums of money. He's the only person really who has that capability. And when Falwell was having trouble with his Liberty University, down in Southwest Virginia, and in fact he was on the verge of bankruptcy, Falwell had developed a lot of arrangements for financing Liberty University, which were essentially gone bad and he was in default. Moon arranged to help support a couple of individuals in a related operation. They had something called the Christian Heritage Foundation, I think it was called. And those same people, once they got this grant from Moon, they were able to then spend a large chunk of that money on buying up the debt that Falwell had run up for his Liberty University. And they bought it up at a fraction of the price that some of these sincere Christians who had bought these bonds had paid. So they basically, these sincere Christians who were in Texas and other places ended up losing their shirts. But after having Moon's money, these folks were able to buy up that debt and bail Liberty University out of its financial crisis. Falwell keeps insisting that he's not beholden to Moon. He has said for times he's never been photographed with Moon, although we found pictures of him standing next to Moon. He's always tried to play down his Moon connection. But it's quite clear that Falwell, as many other conservatives in the Washington area have found, is that Moon will help them out when they are in the most severe economic trouble. And that's how Moon builds his networking throughout the conservative movement.
Veteran listeners will also recall in our discussions with Daniel Hopsicker, the author of Welcome to Terrorland, that Wally Hilliard, an apparent drug smuggler, at least someone whose airlines were being used for drug smuggling and who was the co-owner of one of the flight schools at which some of the September 11th hijackers trained, also bestowed some $1 million on Jerry Falwell. So the Lord is truly smiling on Jerry Falwell in his enterprises to save all of our souls. Real quickly, Robert, we're almost out of time here. Let's continue with our discussion of Reverend Moon. But real quickly, in sanctifying, or at least in bailing out Moon from some of his legal troubles or PR troubles, two names that crop up in connection with that and that also have meaning to perhaps younger listeners and more contemporary events, Mr. Sherwood and also current FBI Director Robert Mueller. Tell us about their roles in helping to exonerate Moon or at least clear up his name.
Well, there have been different times when American citizens have gotten a look at Moon's operation and been shocked by it. There was a PBS documentary in the early 1990s that exposed some of the Moon financial shenanigans. And that led to a number of Americans just writing to the Department of Justice saying, why isn't this guy being investigated? And one of the people who slapped back those requests was Robert Mueller, who was then a senior Department of Justice official. And he made various excuses for why the DOJ could not look into Moon. And that's how it's generally worked. The DOJ will find endless reasons why Moon should not be investigated, whether it's his First Amendment rights, whether he is, because he now has a green card, he can't be examined for foreign agent registration violations. They're always trying to find ways not to investigate Moon, despite the clear evidence, including firsthand testimony by his daughter-in-law, of the money laundering operations. So Mueller and not just Mueller, but many people in the Justice Department have joined in this effort to protect Moon.
Robert Sherwood helped to bail out Moon and also was involved in the character assassination of John Kerry. Very quickly, tell us about Mr. Sherwood, if you would.
Well, Sherwood worked for Moon at the Washington Times and then did a book which essentially was an attack piece against the people who had investigated Moon. There had been this congressional investigation in the late 70s, and this had been carried over into a prosecution of Moon in the early 1980s. And Carlton Sherwood took the role of essentially defending Moon and saying he was being persecuted. And it included harsh attacks on the people who had tried to bring Moon to justice and to expose his operations. And Carlton Sherwood apparently made a good deal of money on this. He was he later had it republished by the Regnery Publishing Company. And according to some accounts, Regnery had been promised that Moon would buy 100,000 copies off the top, which of course would have made it a very lucrative undertaking for Mr. Regnery.
And how did he figure this past summer in the assault on John Kerry? Because we're out of time here.
He also was doing a documentary that was the controversial one that the Sinclair Company was trying to air, which attacked John Kerry essentially for being a traitor. And that was done by the same guy who did the protection of Reverend Moon back in the early 1980s.
All righty. Well, we will continue with our discussion of Reverend Moon and what that organization is and what it's doing, because it's right at the epicenter of what's going on in Washington and the United States. We've been visiting with Robert Perry, the author of Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. And that is available through consortiumnews.com. Remember, www.spitfirelist.com. That's the website for the CD duplication service that stocks all of my material. The For the Record shows are being archived on Real Audio by WFMU. Check out www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery for the streaming Real Audio versions of the more recent programs. For Robert Perry, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening to Side 2 of For the Record program number 490, being recorded on December 12th of 2004.